I'm Mandalit Del Barco, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. It's time now for our weekly visit to the barbershop, where the guys talk about what's in the news and what's on their minds. Sitting in their chairs for a shape-up this week, we have freelance writer Jimmy Israel, civil rights attorney and editor Arsalan Iftikhar, Johns Hopkins University political science professor Lester Spence, and NPR's own political editor Ken Rudin. Take it away, Jimmy.
Hey, Mandy, welcome to the shop. How you
doing? Oh, no, not Mandy. I'm sorry. Anything but Mandy, okay?
You can't hold me and stop me from shaking, but then you take me away, oh, Mandy.
Nah.
Jimmy, her Del Barco is worse than Del Bido.
Oh, gosh. What it is for another session in the shop. How we doing?
Hey.
You doing good?
Cold chilling.
Okay, so check this out. Congress is back in session, and it's all about health care. The latest development was Montana Senator Max Baucus unveiling a long-awaited new bill. Now, no surprise, it's getting no love from the GOP.
Well, the funny thing, Jimmy, is that Max Baucus is the chairman of the Senate Finance Committee. This is the bill that everybody was waiting for the longest time. It was supposed to be with a bipartisan effort. Once upon a time, Max Baucus headed up the Gang of Six. But when Baucus unveiled his plan this week, he basically was the Gang of One. He had no Republican support. The Republicans said it was too expensive. And Democrats were not too crazy about it because it didn't have the public option. But he did say that there will be revisions made. There will be amendments made. So what Max Baucus offered this week will not be the final product.
Right. I mean, a lot of people are looking at this and they're saying it's the best thing they've seen come down the pike. But this is before the Finance Committee gets a hold of it, right?
Absolutely.
L. Spence, what do you say, good doc?
Well, I think that one of the challenges they have from the jump is that they, when you frame the issue as one of costs rather than investment, it skews it rightward anyway. But then when you have the GOP, and they've indicated from the onset of the Obama presidency that they're not really willing to support anything he does. Mm-hmm. It just makes it really, really difficult. So you have a framing issue that skews the bill to the right, but then the right themselves aren't willing to make any suggestions that make the bill palatable to them. So then the left ends up being upset. The right kind of gets what they want, but the people end up being left out.
You know what? There's also these questions about who regulates what and how that still loom really large in this conversation. A-Train, what's interesting to me is that Press Secretary Robert Gibbs, he called this an important building block. Do you concur? Of course you do.
Well,
go ahead.
Well, why'd you ask a question if you didn't want the answer, Jimmy?
No, go ahead, bro. Get it.
What's most interesting to me is, you have these blue dog Democrats like Max Baucus and conservative Democrats in the House who are essentially log jamming, this entire healthcare debate there. I mean, Rahm Emanuel, Dick Durbin, the majority whip in the House, they've not done a good job in terms of whipping together votes. That's why they haven't gotten the Republican support that they've needed. The Republicans have no incentive, to be a part of this.
And to amplify on what Lester was just saying before, the reason we spent so much time focusing on Max Baucus's committee and Max Baucus's plan, because we thought this was going to be the instrument that would attract Republican support. We know the ones that are passing in the House are completely Democrat only with no Republican input. So we thought Baucus's thing would be important because it would have Republican support. And now that that has no Republican support, we're back to where we started.
And it's interesting. I personally, I think it's too early to call this thing a panacea. I think people are just kind of speaking out of turn, and we should let it do what it do. But speaking of people speaking out of turn, former President Jimmy Carter, in my opinion, was kind of off the rails. We said Congressman Joe Wilson was heckling Barack Obama last week. He said he wasn't just heckling him, but he said he was being kind of racist. We got some tape. Don't we?
That's right, Jimmy. We have audio of former President Jimmy Carter, who said this in answer to a question from an audience member at his presidential center in Atlanta.
An overwhelming portion of the intensely demonstrated animosity toward President Barack Obama is based on the fact that he is a black man, that he's African American. I live in the South, and I've seen the South come a long way, and I've seen the rest of the country that shared the South's attitude toward minority groups at that time, particularly African Americans. That racism inclination still exists. And I think it's bubbled up to the surface because of a belief among many white people, not just in the South but around the country, that African Americans are not qualified to lead this great country.
And you know, guys, the response from the Republican National Committee Chairman Michael Steele was that President Carter was flat out wrong. He said it's not about race, it's about policy, and it's a what he called a pathetic distraction. What do you guys think?
You know what, Dr. Spence, I think that Jimmy Carter is out of pocket. I think he has to be careful. You know what I mean? You cannot conflate any criticism of the president into racism. And I think it's unfortunate that Jimmy Carter's from that old school era. He's an old school Southern white guy, and he's going back to those days, and he's trying to make this about race. But I think it was rude. But I don't think Wilson was racist. What do you think, Doc?
I think that one of the challenges here is that we're so used to talking about race as if it's a game, as if it's a card that's played, that we don't talk about racism enough. It's clear to me, even though it's funny, because I actually am glad that that Wilson did what he did. I think the only problem about him yelling what he yelled was that he was empirically wrong. But with that said, it's very clear that Joe Wilson's act was driven by racism. I mean, so do you recall what he actually yelled at in response to? He yelled that in response to a comment about illegal immigration. What's Joe Wilson's own history? Not only is he a representative of South Carolina, but he's engaged in a number of practices. He supported a number of efforts that are clearly tied to the old and new Confederacy, right? So it's Jimmy Carter is absolutely on point. And the challenge is addressing that in a way that gets us towards more humane policy as opposed to getting us to better, quote unquote, decorum in congressional hearings. So wait,
was the point racist or was it racist to criticize the president? I mean, I'm a little confused as to what you're saying.
Okay.
I mean, because you're talking about Wilson's policies, Wilson's policies could be construed to be racist. But
right.
Here's me. I'm not sure that Wilson wouldn't have tried to down-talk Bush if Bush had been up there talking the same yip-yap.
No.
I don't know. I guess I'm too willing to give him the benefit of the doubt maybe, right?
Well, I give him the benefit of the doubt that he had I wish more of us had the cojones to do that with the guy that was in the office before Obama. But what I'm saying is that the race works in a number of different ways in this moment. And what we have to do is think about the way race could work. It's not just a matter of it being cut and dry. Is he a racist? Isn't he? It's like, how does race work in this moment? It's a matter of, on one hand, issues that have been implicitly racialized, right? So healthcare reform has become an implicitly racialized issue. The other question is what type of interactions do we have on a micro level between a guy who's supposed to get a certain amount of respect because of the time we live in, and just a regular guy, right? Under what circumstances would a regular guy feel it's basically right to yell at the president, right? Is it just a coincidence in that case that Obama's black instead of not being black?
I just don't want us to get to a point where we're dealing in Sharpton politics, where if a black hamster gets into it with a white hamster, you know, we call it NAACP.
Can I just jump in here for a moment and say, if you're just joining us, you're listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Mandalit Del Barco, and we're in the barbershop speaking with journalists Jimmy Israel, Arsalan Iftikhar, Ken Rudin, and political science professor Lester Spence. Jimmy, you're up again.
All right. Well, you know what? This week, even Barack Obama rebuked Kanye West's behavior at the MTV VMA Awards this week when Kanye commandeered the microphone from country singer Taylor Swift to give props to singer Beyonce. I believe we have some tape of Obama going in on Kanye. Is that right?
That's right. And for anybody who might not have seen this, this was when country singer Taylor Swift just won her award for Best Female Video. Kanye West came up and grabbed the mic and told America why Beyonce got robbed of her award. I heard it being described as stepping on a kitten. But here's President Obama's reaction to Kanye West.
I thought that was really inappropriate. Yeah. You know, I mean, it's like she's getting an award. What are you buttoning? I hear you. I agree with you.
Does that count as the first question?
The young lady seems like a perfectly nice person. She's getting her award. What's he doing up there?
Why would he do that?
He's a jackass.
Well, you know there's a problem when the president goes in on you. You know you've really messed up. A-Train.
Yeah, you know, this week I couldn't figure out who to give the redunculous award to between Kanye and Serena Williams' outrageous outburst at the U.S. Open against Kim Clijsters, but Kanye West, as my fellow Chicagoan, gets both the redunculous and the come on man award. I mean, here you are, you're my age, you're a grown man of 32 years old, and you're gonna pull a fourth grade stunt. I mean, you're the guy who wrote Jesus Walked, so I gotta say Jesus Walked right out of your head on that one while you're on stage. Kanye, you get the redunculous.
He did apologize, though, right?
So, I don't care if he apologized.
You know what? You know what's interesting to me? 50 Cent said, I wish he would come up and try to take my award. He said, I blacked that eye. And my name is Jimmy Israel, and I support that message, FYI.
A lot of the stuff I saw on the web was also criticizing the media for picking up on President Obama's comment, because it was not part of it. It was like an off-the-cuff comment that was preceding an interview, which reminds me of the famous conversation with Milton Coleman, the former Washington Post reporter, who was part of a conversation with Jesse Jackson in 1983 mentioned Jaime and Jaimetown. Mm-hmm. And the question was whether it was legitimate enough to report a private or off-the-record or off-the-record conversation. Obviously, nothing in this day and age is off the record.
You got to be careful when you're in front of a mic somehow.
Right. All right, well, speaking of people in front of mics, somehow Whitney Houston got in front of a mic and sat down to talk with Oprah about her troubled marriage and drug addiction this week. Now, Manda, you saw that, right?
Yeah, some of us here at Tell Me More were huddled around the TV watching that interview. It was a two-parter that aired Monday and Tuesday, and here's a clip from that segment where Whitney Houston talks about her past drug use with her ex-husband, Bobby Brown.
There were times where, you know what, he would smash things, break things in the home. We had a big, big, giant portrait of me and him and my child. He cut my head off the picture, you know, stuff like that. And I thought, this is really strange. So I figured, cutting my head off the picture, that was a little much for me. Okay, it was like, okay. That was one sign, and then there were other. that was. And then there were other things, like, you know, he started to paint in our room, my bedroom. Evil eyes.
Evil eyes.
Wow, daggone! This sound like you know, excerpts from The Shining. You know, thanks for that. You know, what's problematic for me, because I saw it too, and Dr. Spence, I don't know if you want to go here with me. Because you have a wife to go home to, so maybe you don't. But for me, there was a – in Whitney, I found this really troubling lack of personal accountability. Now, let's get that she went through a lot, right? But she was also holding the purse strings, and she could have left at any given time. And I felt like Oprah trying to get her to apologize for standing by her vows was really troubling and ugly. And I was done with it when the daughter came on. When she brought the daughter on, I thought that was really odorous. You know, if you're going to go in on the husband, you know, don't involve the child. And I'm not convinced that this wasn't just kind of this staged Oprah Winfrey moment to help Whitney Houston get back on the charts again.
I think the issue of domestic abuse is something that's really, really serious, right? And and I think that it's something that we should talk more about, but it has to be a better way to address that in a way that actually gives people the space to speak about their own stuff, that gives us the space to kind of create some policies. It's clear, and I really hope that Whitney does well. It's good to see her kind of sort of trying to get her groove back. But you don't talk about that. I mean, talking about that stuff as a way to sell albums is just really, really distasteful to me.
Right. I agree. A-Train?
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, when I watched this interview, I didn't really see anything or hear anything that I didn't already know about Whitney and Bobby. You know, I don't think that it added, and I didn't see any news hook to it. You know, I agree with you guys. I think it was kind of, I mean, let's be honest, Bobby and Whitney have been media personalities, a media phenomenon, if you will, you know, both as individuals and as, you know, one conjoined and now disjointed unit. It's really sad to see. I mean, for me, it just speaks to, you know, our overarching love and cult of celebrity. You know, once you're off the cameras, you're going to find any way to get back on, whether it's by Celebrity Fit Club or being on Big Brother 7 or, you know, it's just like people can't let go of fame and celebrity and they will find any way to try and get back. And it's kind of sad.
It's like she's replaced.
I was just really troubled that, you know, she really pointed the finger at Bobby. and you know, Bobby made me, you know, and I don't buy it. I'm sorry, because you know she's holding. I mean, she could have got out of that situation at any point in time she wanted to. It's not a situation where Bobby was in control. You know, she gave him control, and for me, she never took that personal accountability. She never did. She didn't. Not for me.
Jimmy,
so
let me disagree with you a little bit, because we never know what causes people to stay or leave, and what you know, how much life could be hell, and yet people stay for an assortment of reasons. But I thought what I got out of the interview mostly was the fact, and of course we knew a lot of the stuff as Arsalan mentioned, but when you talk about fame and celebrity, it's not all what it's cracked out to be, and you know, right. there's a lot of horrible stories out there, and I thought it was a little inner look at somebody so famous and so much of a celebrity.
Yeah. I wonder if Oprah Winfrey is going to have Bobby Brown on her show.
For me, that would have been fair. That would have been fair. And I also thought it was really, I mean, I didn't see any reason on God's earth to have this daughter involved in this, ugh.
When Bobby's album comes out, it's on.
You think so?
It's going to be called Prerogative versus Prerogative.
You know, and of course, we know we're happy to see Whitney recover from her addictions and pulling herself up. At the same time, you know, I'd much rather not see her air out her daughter's father on TV.
But
I think that's real talk.
I think the name of Bobby Brown's album would be Houston, We Have a Problem.
Yeah, but what's love got to do with that?
Right, exactly. We're all over the place. And as Whitney might say, my name is not Susan. My name is Jimmy Iz, and I got to call it a wrap. Thank you so much, everybody, for coming out to the shop. I have to kick it over to the woman of the house, standing in for the woman of the house, Mondelit Del Barco.
Thank you, Jimmy. Jimmy Israel is a freelance journalist who writes for TheRoot.com. He's also a presidential fellow at Case Western Reserve University in Cleveland, Ohio, and he joined us from member station WCPN in Cleveland. Arsalan Iftikhar is the founder of themuslimguide.com and a civil rights attorney. And Ken Rudin is NPR's political editor. And we are also joined by Lester Spence, a political science professor at Johns Hopkins University. All of them were kind enough to join me here in our Washington studios. Thanks to all of you.
And that's our program for today. Our technical director is Kimberly Jones. She had a hand from Neil Tebow and Gregory Gavin. Our theme music was composed by Underdog Entertainment with additional arrangements by Ian Honeyman. I'm Mandalit Del Barco. Michelle Martin will be back next week. You've been listening to Tell Me More from NPR News and the African American Public Radio Consortium. Let's talk more on Monday.